Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Matt Paxton, one of the nation's leading experts on downsizing, decluttering, and guiding families through major life transitions. You may know Matt from A&E's Hoarders or from Filthy Fortunes on Discovery, where he helps older adults uncover the stories behind their most meaningful possessions. Matt, welcome to Roundtable Talk.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So let's talk about clutter, something so many older adults struggle with during major life transitions. You often say clutter is never about the stuff. What is it really about?
Man, it is never about the stuff. I'm glad you started with that. It's always about the people and the memories attached to the stuff. So I always say it's not about the dining room table. It's about the people that sat at the dining room table. Or more importantly, the people that don't sit at the table anymore.
Well said. So why do you think letting go becomes harder as we age?
Well, it's proof that we existed. You know, it's proof that we mattered. It's proof that they mattered. I mean, I you and I met at a senior living conference and at SMASH, and I interviewed 100 of my, we clean houses all over the country. We don't just do it on TV. We do it in real life as well.
Sure.
And we interviewed 100 clients last year, and the number one fear was that their parents would be forgotten when they leave. So like, think about it. This is on average 65 to 85 year old client that they're worried about their parents who have been gone for 30 plus years. And they're afraid that once they leave this planet, their parents are wiped and the memories of them. And I think about, my dad died when I was 25. Like my kids never, I have 7 kids. My kids never met my dad. And I get that fear. I totally get that fear. And I think that's why a lot of us, as we age, we hold on to things so deeply. And then you also have to get in the demographics of America. Like you can't ignore the demographics when we were born. I mean, the people that the boomers that are passing right now were the kids of the greatest generation, which were the kids of the Depression. And so we've got a really unique thing where, like, you know, my mom was 22 when she had me. I was 34 when I had my first kid. So like you have a generation with the boomers and the greatest generation that they grew up together and they were very tightly bound. I mean, there's a 10 to 15 year gap between the next two generations. And so when you really look at the math of aging, like this is the last generation that grew up together, that, you know, there's 3 generations under 60. Yep. That's pretty amazing when you think about it. And so they had family time. And then I think, you know, we're near the holidays right now where we're filming and, you know, the family started in the living room, or the family started in the dining room. And I think that's a hard thing for this next two generations to understand. I mean, I'm in my dining room right now, and it's really my office and a music room for my kids.
That's right.
It was a holy place for my grandma.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as you're talking, I'm old enough where we got china when we were married, and I have my mother's china, and I know my son isn't going to care about either of them.
And it doesn't mean he didn't care about you and your mom. He just doesn't need that china to do it. He does it through another item. It might be like your briefcase or your watch, or like for my kids, it's a paddleboard. I get my one-on-one time with my kids on my paddleboard. And for me, I have my grandma's bowl. I'm going to make, at Thanksgiving this year, I'll make some really cool apricot pies out of my grandma's bowl because I remember that with my grandma. My kids don't need that. They need something else.
That's well said. So it's not easy for families to start the process or approach the topic. Mm-hmm. Is there a healthy way for families to start these conversations before a crisis forces them? And as you say, we're coming into a holiday season and there'll be lots of people gathering, lots of conversations. Hopefully it stays off politics. And, might be a good topic.
This is the first year where talking about the clutter is better than talking about politics. Right? I mean, I always jokingly say, and by the way, Friday, so the day after Thanksgiving is the busiest day of the year for my business. We get our most phone calls on Friday. And that's because everybody goes home. They go home to see mom and they say, oh gosh, we got to do something. And then it takes a year or two to do something. My advice is always don't talk about the mess if you can see the mess. So So I'll say that again. Don't talk about the mess if you can see the mess. But the only time you want to talk about it is when you see it.
Yep.
And the reason we say that is it's the trauma, right? It's the drama. We call it the amas. And it's hard. You know, you have to step back. And remember, I built all this off being, I was on hoarders for 15 years. So for the first 10 years of my career, all I did was the most extreme cases in the world. And we just did extreme hoarding. And so I teach a lot of these lessons to families now based upon the most extreme situations where your family's probably half that, right? Or maybe even 40% that. But the lessons all relay. And what I'll say is you first start off with, hey, we love you. You have to really, really stress the love. I mean, I've changed my verbiage drastically in the last 20 years. I used to walk into a hoarded house. Oh my gosh, this is so gross. It's so filthy. How do you let it get like this? Why do you live this way? Something anyone listening right now would say to their loved ones. And really what you have to say is, wow, you had a really big family. You had a lot of love because it's all caused by trauma and loss of people that matter. And we're trying to fill that hole with stuff. Many people would fill it with drugs or alcohol or working out or work or fitness, or it could be anything. And I'm throwing a lot, faith, it could be any, I'm throwing all that in there, right? We're looking for happiness and self-worth in something else. For a hoarder, it's stuff. You really have to, if you're talking to a loved one, you have to change the tone to, hey, okay, we had a lot of love here. A lot of people have moved on. That's why we're sad. And that's why we're holding on to stuff. And if you really come with that compassionate tone, it changes the whole conversation. And then you have to get aligned on the finish line. The finish line is probably the most. When I say the finish line, is like, where are we going? Like, what's happening next? Yep. And that's why you and I met at a senior living conference, because that's the finish line for a lot of our clients.
That's right.
They're going to move to senior living. And now what has really changed in the last 20 years, I started this when I was 25. I'm 50 this year. So I've been doing it longer than I haven't. And I started it because my dad, my stepdad, both my grandfathers passed away. People always think, you know, and I didn't do this because I had this brilliant idea. I was available. Everyone else was working. I was a kid. And all those men passed away and I had to clean out their houses. But for me, I just really, really stress, like, okay, what's the finish line? Where are they going to go? And then we have to get aligned on that. We have to get aligned. And then that's the impetus to say, okay, all right, now we're going to put a plan together. And it takes the emotion. It can't be like, you're filthy, grandma. What's wrong with you? That doesn't help. It's not effective. You know, when I started this 25 years ago, grandma was Rosie the Riveter. Grandma, I mean, like, you can't put grandma down. Grandma did some, I mean, I had a lot of, we started this in Richmond, Virginia, which was really, became a suburb of Washington, D.C. It's 2 hours, but it still it is. And like, we would find all these top secret documents of these badass women that did some amazing things during the war. And you're like, this is not a fragile little lady. Like, she did amazing things. And their family's talking to her like she's just this little old lady that can't do anything.
You know, that's interesting the way you talk about that it's, you know, certainly decluttering, but it's also almost...
Dude, it's an archaeological dig.
Archaeological dig.
It is an arc. That's why I love my job every day. It is an archaeological dig. I get to find out when grandma was the coolest person in the world. And grandma's still cool. It's just grandkids don't know it.
But it's dimensionalized now.
Yeah. Oh, I think I told this story all the time on stage. I don't know if you heard it or not, but like we have a thing called hot grandma that we use in the, because you always find a picture of this little old lady that you're helping. You find a picture of when she's 16 or 18 and she's like knockout gorgeous, you know, it never fails. And so we always hold that picture for when grandma's having a rough time in the cleanup. It's totally manipulative. It's very strategic, but you bring it out and you say, oh, who's this? And she goes, oh, that's me. And you go, oh, you don't say. And you're like, wow. And she's like smoking a cigarette. She's wearing a skirt that's too short, you know, and you just can't believe it. And, you know, in this one time we had this lady in this Lennis, she's having a rough go. And we brought, and it was her adult daughter and her adult granddaughter in the room. They were just struggling because they'd been in the house 70 some years. It was her mom's house. And so she was grieving all these people. So I looked at my coworker. I said, it's hot grandma. Come on, hot grandma. Bring me the picture. So he brings out hot grandma and we show the picture. We do the dance. Who's this? Oh, that's me. You don't say. And then the granddaughter goes, who's that? That's not grandpa. And it was some dude in a World War II outfit. And we quickly find out, and she's like, oh, that's Armando. And she says it very like extraction. That's Armando. And we're like, she goes, he was my lover. And we're like, what? She goes, well, she goes, I was an adjunct professor at MIT. She goes, they let women teach that year. And she goes, I was an adjunct art history professor. And he was a Spanish professor. And she goes, Spanish history. And she goes, and we had a torrid love affair. And she keeps saying how much sex they had, right? And like, the room is just like, oh, we can't believe it, right? And she's proudly like proclaiming how much sex she had with Armando. And she goes, and then she goes, he moved back to Spain. She goes, I met your father the next summer when he came back from the war. And we were, and they were married 50 some years, right? And we're all just like, you know, mouths on the floor. And the granddaughter goes, you taught at MIT? And she goes, yeah, I was the first female adjunct professor.
Right? Amazing how these stories can come out.
Never would have come out, man. That granddaughter never knew her grandma was this in total badass for a lot of different reasons, right? We found out too many reasons in that story. But like, it was incredible. It sets the tone, right? So like now you're like, okay, well, the National Geographics don't mean anything.
Right.
You know, like grandpa's old stacks of, you know, underwear that we're saving because they're good rags. Like that doesn't matter, you know? And I'm saying this very deliberately because it's fascinating when you hear these stories. And this is what I get to do every single day. I mean, every day, this is our job. And it's when I say our archaeological dig, I mean, it is socially, it is economically, it is emotionally, it is everything. I mean, it is incredible. And the reason I'm digging into this is when you're cleaning out your grandma's house, for you, for us younger generations, we're just trying to bang out this in 3 days to get it done so we can get back to our life. And what I want to argue is actually, this is where you need to spend your time. This is the most fascinating week of your life. It could be the most interesting week and the most productive and, you know, generationally changing week of your life if you really sit down and look at it as an archaeological dig as opposed to an inconvenient couple of days.
Sure. And I'm sure for you, it's fascinating, but for the families you support, it can be life-changing in some ways.
Life-changing, man. I mean, the little lesser value of that, but like the dress that lady was wearing in the picture, of course we found it in the attic. Of course we did 70 years later or 65 years later. And the granddaughter ended up having it cut up and made into handkerchiefs for her wedding party. Right?
That's
and
cool.
Told everybody that story. It sounds a little silly, but like that lady ended up, you know, looking at other colleges because she found out her mom. I mean, you talk about generational change. That granddaughter literally was like, "Well, if my grandma can teach at MIT, I can apply somewhere else." And it, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I think we don't realize, you know. And then sometimes we just find money that people have no clue, right? That generationally changed. I mean, like we found just the other day, we found a stock certificate in a house. Just one stock certificate, but it's worth about $400,000.
Wow. Wow.
And it had not been converted. And family didn't know what it was. They'd never seen a digital stock certificate before, or a non-digital stock certificate. It was just an old, beautiful piece of paper. They thought it was art. I was like, no, this is live money. And then it was like, it's like 400, like 440. And they were like, they didn't even know how they were going to pay us. Like they were that broke.
Mm-hmm.
And we found over $1 million in that house between cash and stocks and jewelry and gold. And it was like, man, and I don't mean to say that money always changes families, but for that family, they needed that and it changed them. And sometimes it's just something, you know, emotional.
And like you say, completely found.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think there's 20 grand in every house. I really do. Of like unfound stuff, even when you think there's nothing, but that emotional stuff, the time, I mean, I cannot stress, you know, almost, there's pretty much, you know, almost every house we can do in a week. It just depends on the size of the team. For more than 5 days is too much emotional for anybody. And so we really try to cap it at 5 days. And there's kind of a dance to it. There's a bell curve, right, of a 5 day. First day is hard. Second day is harder. Wednesday, they make the turn. Wednesday, Thursday, they have these emotional just turnarounds and finds. And then you really celebrate Friday and the house is totally empty. And they get their life back. And it's really fascinating to see. But yeah, it's every emotional journey you can imagine we see.
That's great that you're able to kind of guide them on that journey. I know when I, my father passed about a decade ago at 93 and he, you know, I helped him 20 some odd years ago, downsize his house, the house I grew up in, and then, downsize from the one bedroom assisted living apartment into a skilled nursing. And then, you know, when he passed at the skilled nursing, you know, there were like 4 boxes left. It was just interesting to kind of think about how it whittles down now. Granted, I'd already taken a lot of the stuff back, but, you know, there's a whole lot.
You're hitting the life cycle. It goes from a 50-gen, you know, you burn a house 50 years that you grew up in and you could spend 2 days in the attic, you know, or the basement. And then it gets down to, okay, now it's just like, you know, it's a one bedroom. So it's a, you know, it's 20 boxes. And then, yeah, I mean, it's really amazing when you get down to it. It's three or four boxes. I mean, we had one house like that in LA, and it was a guy, the daughter never knew what the dad did. He would always jokingly say it was top secret. And we got into the garage and we got into that one of those. It was that second. She'd already done one downsize. We get into the next downsize. And she goes, oh, that's his box from work. He never let us go through it. And we get into it and it's pens and scissors and, you know, notepads and business cards. And then we found like an old Ziploc bag and it didn't have a zipper. It was the one, the sandwich bag you would flip over. And if you're listening, you have to be old enough. You have 50 to understand. But it was a Ziploc bag that didn't have a zipper on it, right? It would just fold over. But if you're over 50, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
The old baggie, I think
we would call it. Yeah, the baggie. And it had scotch tape on it. It said, to the moon and back. And it looked like this piece of honeycomb. And so we started doing some research. We started finding out this guy did indeed work at Lockheed Martin. And then we found out, within the end of the day, this was a piece of Apollo 11. He was the chief engineer. And we later found out he was not only chief engineer, he was one of the first Korean-born engineers at NASA. And Lockheed Martin reached out to us. So this was on a TV show. We were lucky to have all this information. Sure. Lockheed Martin reached out and they're like, here's all the recruiting videos your dad did for NASA going after Asian-born engineers.
And the family had no idea.
No clue, dude. Not one ounce of no, because he didn't win. But he also just felt like you went to work. That was work. It was separate. It didn't matter for family. And I kind of respect that, honestly. But here I am holding a piece of something that went to the moon, right?
That's amazing.
And this guy's just like, it's private. Don't need to bother my kids with it, you know. Nope. And it was a piece of the honeycomb. And as soon as we were able to identify it, everyone at NASA and at Lockheed Martin knew exactly what it was. And they were like, yeah, he was one of the engineers. And so the guy, when the astronauts got back, they shaved it off and they gave it a little piece to everybody.
So it was just sitting in a box and in a closet attic or something. Wow.
Yeah. It was fascinating. I mean, that's the stuff, you know, and it's just like, and I, of course, one of my sons wants to be a pilot. So I was able to take a picture of it, show it to him. And I was like, dude, and I was like, you could go to the moon. Like this guy went to the moon. I mean, he was in a camp. He was in a internment camp at one point.
Yep.
Like, think about that, man. Like, I mean, it's really just amazing the stories that come out of these houses. And that's why I'm so passionate about it. I mean, it's just incredible the stuff we find. And so to a very long answer to your original question, you know, it's never about the stuff. It's all the journey. It's all the stories. It's from internment camp all the way to helping people get on the moon. Sure. Like, that's what stuff is about. And does it motivate us as the next generation to be special?
You know? I remember you sharing a story when I heard you speak at Smash about something that you took from your father that you now are having your home and appreciating with your son. Are you able to? Do you mind sharing that story?
The reading chair.
The chair. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So my dad had a really awesome. You know, I sat in my dad's chair. I think a lot of us, the dad had a chair. And it sat by our window, right? And we would wait for my dad to come home from work every night. He had a 1981 BMW 320i, so it was very distinctive circular headlights. There was two on either side, so it was four headlights. And of course, one was always out, so my dad only had three lights. You know, we called those padiddles when we were kids. But it was a very exciting thing to sit there, right? And then I don't know why, but when my dad left, when my dad and my mom split, the chair was still at our house for a while. Probably because he lived out of his car. I don't know, but it was probably not a good part of the story, but it doesn't matter. Right.
And I don't remember that part of the story, but
I don't remember that part. Like my Christmas, like when I would come down for Christmas morning, my stuff would be in my dad's chair, you know, and we would. And so when my dad died, he ended up being in his house and I loved that chair. I would sit in that chair with my dad when he got older and we'd smoke cigars in that chair. It was a lifelong journey. That chair was. And when my dad died, I wanted that chair. And I got it. And it was a 1956 Eames. Like, I'll never forget it. And it was a really special chair. And then when I got it, turns out it was a knockoff 1972 Sears. It was not an Eames, which made more sense. Right. At this point. Yeah. But I got the chair and it stayed in my life. And now my kids sit in that chair.
I love
and
that.
It's the reading chair. And they didn't know my dad. They know of him, but they didn't know him. And there were a lot of complicated things. I I make my dad very romantic, but it was a lot of complicated things. My dad too. And,
but how great to have that connection.
Yeah. Oh, well, and so this is the best part of the chair. My kids are not athletes. My kids are academic and musical. And so they sit in that chair and they sit in that chair and when they, it's their reading chair. And so when they get, anyone knows when someone gets in that chair that they're on the last chapter of a book. And so when we were, we have six boys and one girl. And so when we were going through Harry Potter, like there was someone sitting in that chair almost every day, you know, and it became a situation where my kids would go in there and you'd gather around the chair and people would start to clap and you get to the last page and everybody hoots and hollers and they shut the page and they tell us what the book's about.
That's fantastic. And,
well, I knew my kids early on were not going to get carried off the field on someone's shoulders like Rudy, you know, like that's not the cards our family was dealt, but they are at very extremely academic. And so I wanted to make that special. And so ironically, like that chair has become something way beyond what
that's great.
I ever, and what my dad, no, my dad would love it. He would think it's really cool. And the problem now is it's like, okay, well, when I die, like who gets the chair?
Yeah.
You know, like,
but the thing is that, I mean, that's at the core of your business. And it's, yeah. I thought that was so cool how that's such a personal story, but yet it's, either that led to lessons that you've taken into your business and your, you know, TV work, or vice versa. Maybe, you know, the TV the work led to recognizing that.
The lesson we would give at work is divvy that, you know, literally share custody of the chair. I know that sounds silly, but like let that chair, if there's three kids that want it, then 6 months at one person's house, 6 months at another, and it sounds silly, but like, if that's the memory that you all want to hold on to, great. Let's share it. Let's celebrate it.
Don't have the familial tension where only one gets it.
I mean, I can't tell you how many families I've seen just breaking up, totally break up over stuff. And it's really sad. I mean, it's super sad. I mean, I've had families, I haven't talked to my brother in 10 years. Because of a sofa? Really? Because of a guitar? Like, the one thing I can prove, you know, the old George Carlin thing, like, you can't take it with you. And you can't. And King Tut's the only guy that took it all with him.
That's right. And it's finally, I just saw yesterday that it's all on display now in a museum in Cairo. Finally.
Yeah, finally. Right. It went around the U.S. forever.
Well, that's right.
Like, what I mean, you know, it's so cheesy, but it's the journey. It's not the destination. Mm-hmm. Yep. Right. And I will say, I mean, I'm very lucky. Someone asked me the math the other day. I was telling you earlier before we started, like, there's that one book that tells you your 10,000 hours.
Yep. I think that's Malcolm Gladwell.
Malcolm Gladwell. Yep. So it's 10,000 hours to be an expert. So I was wondering, well, gosh, in 25 years, how much time have I spent in hoarded houses? And it was 300,000 hours spent in hoarded houses.
Amazing.
And let me summarize 300,000 hours for you. It's never about the stuff and you can't take it with you.
And well said.
It's all about time. Like my currency now is time. I mean, I'm 50, right? Like, that's not old, but my dad was 52 when he died. You know, so that's close. And one of my sons came to me. I got six boys. So 12, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. And there's no 14. So 12, 12, 11, 15, 16. But the 15-year-old's kind of an asshole. And because he's 15, you know. And he's like, Dad, I read that the average age of a man is 74. How does it make you feel that you're in the last third of your life? I'm like, oh, God. You know, I felt great until you said it like that. Like, I mean, honestly, I think I'm 50 this year. I feel like I'm just starting to get it. Like, I'm just getting in a groove. I can pay all my bills finally, you know, like in the same month. And I can go to dinner with my family and relax and enjoy. And I'm happy. Yep. But he's not wrong, right? Like,
That is interesting from a 15-year-old. It's, you know, kind of prescient to even think that way.
It's just a mathematical equation for him.
Right.
You know, he's just like, well, all right, you're in the last third. Like, he's not emotional to him.
Right.
To me, it was heavily emotional. Right. But it did get in my brain. And I say to all my clients, I'm like, okay, like you're 80, dude, you're on borrowed time. Like, do we really want to spend the next 3 years going through pictures of you going to Acapulco in 1980 with your wife? Or do we just want to go to Acapulco one more time with your wife? Let's go make some new memories. And so, like, you'll hear me speak and speak and speak and preach. I mean, I've written books about it. Keep the memories, lose the stuff. Even now, like, let's go make new memories. Like, that's really what living's about, you know? And if you're lucky enough to still be here, Like, let's go make new memories for the grandkids, like make the next generation. Like, I just can't stress how important it is for me that, you know, I want to take some time to celebrate the past, but I don't want to take all the time.
Yeah.
I want to make sure they're still living. And I can't tell you how many people in our world do that. In our senior living world, they focus so much on the past. And again, well, we've already explored why we focus so much on the past, because we love the people that were there. You know, we love them.
Yeah.
And that's great. And let's celebrate them. But there's a lot of people that love us right now. Let's go hang out with them.
And I think this is, probably somewhere in there will be the answer to this question. But we ask every roundtable guest, what are you looking forward to as you age? And let me ask you that, Matt. What do you look forward to as you age?
Oh my gosh. I'm doing it right now, man. I went away with my wife this weekend, just the two of us. And man, we just had a blast, dude. Like, I mean, we have a lot of teenagers. We have seven teenagers.
Do they take care of themselves?
Oh yeah. I mean, yeah, we're lucky. I mean, they're just like,
and all of them were alive when you got back.
Some of them didn't even know we left. Like, I mean, literally, you know, like, that's fine. I mean, but like seeing that next generation, joking and not joking, but like seeing them put stuff together. I mean, like we have an autistic boy that's incredibly musically inclined, and it's really fun to see him like explore music. And he's getting older, right? And so it's now more about music and less about autism. And I just have to say, like, that's probably one of my favorite things. It's just like watching your kids like figure stuff out. And like, I feel more like a life coach than I do a dad now.
That's great.
Sure. And I I come from a long line of entrepreneurs, like a long line of entrepreneurs. And even this in the summer now on my TV shows, like my kids come and work on the TV show.
That's great.
And so like, for me, I think that's like,
how cool is that?
Oh, dude, it's the greatest thing in the world. I got to take my daughter to see New York City for the first time a couple weeks ago. And it was everything that New York City is. You know, we got on a very offensive subway train. She got to experience it. You know, we got to go to an incredible restaurant. We got to go see Times Square. We got to go see a show. Like, we did it all.
That's
like,
great.
That's what I'm loving. I don't want to say I'm looking forward to it. I'm doing it. And I think I'm in the middle of the action. And I think to be able to do that at 50 is really special. Like, I am very lucky that I've been, not many of us got to do what they were put on earth to do in your 20s. And it was totally a mistake, you know, like I was just available, but like, I'm very lucky now. I'm going to be 30, you know, almost, I mean, soon it'll be 30 years I've been doing this, and I'm honestly a kid. I think I'm 20, I'm 50, but like, I love watching my kids figure out who they are. And I'm not even a grandpa yet, but like, and if you're watching, please not anytime soon. But like, I really, really, really love watching my kids figure out who they are. And I know some of them will be entrepreneurs, and I can't wait to work with my kids on their business. Like, they work in mine now, and I love that. And so I just can't wait for them. Like, they're starting to get their own ideas. And that is the coolest thing to me. It's like, all right, cultivating a world where my kids can be creative and figure out what they want to do. Like, you can't see it, but this behind me is our dream board. And this is in our office, and this is a whiteboard where anytime someone has a dream, they want to do something, they put it on the board.
Because when I saw that, I didn't look closely, but I was wondering if that was you plotting out, you know, ideas for your show or books or business.
It used to be my dream board, and now it's the family dream board. And so there's zip codes, there's locations, there's businesses. One of them just says, get my own apartment. That's my daughter's, right? She's ready to move out. But like, I think if you don't provide a place for people to dream, they don't dream as much anymore. Yeah.
And that's a great point.
First is fourth. I mean, it is first and center. It's one of the first things you see walking in the house is our dream board. And then people start, well, what's this? What's that? What's this? And then it gets a family involved and you start dreaming. And then of course, you know, some things get checked off, some get wiped off, and some just get, you know, one wanted to be a zoo keeper. And that was on there for like 5 years. And now everyone's like, nah, past that, you know, want to be a musician, but it's like, cool, whatever. Like, it's all stepping stones too, you know?
Yep.
And that's what's, I think, for me, for a guy that didn't have kids till late in life, like, I freaking love it.
That's great. So I'm curious. So I don't know if you started there, but, you know, at least in the TV world, you were on Hoarders for 15 years. Then you went to the Emmy nominated Legacy list and then Filthy Fortunes. Talk a little about your journey through those three, you know, to your current TV show.
So
So I had been helping families for 5 years, just doing hoarding work on this, you know, just basically like a side hustle, honestly. Like I was just helping families clean, and I knew it was special because I would get a hug and I would get a check. And let me say that twice. Like I would do all this work with people. They'd give me a huge hug and then they would hand me a check. And they always wanted to tip me. And I just thought that was really awkward and weird, but they were like, you changed my life. Like, and I'm like, all right, whatever. Like I was just trying to make rent, you know? And I love doing it. And I was just like, all right, this is special. If they hug me and there's tears and then there's money. And so I made the decision. I was just like, I'm going to try to get on TV. And I was dumb and naive enough.
Good for you.
Yeah, that's not easy. Right. But I didn't get it. And I think I was just too dumb to really, my dad taught me and my grandparents taught me to like go for whatever, you know, anything and everything all the time. Why not? Like, why not you? And that's something I have to tell my kids, all the kids, like, why not you? Like someone's going to do it. Why not you? Now, how hard are you willing to work for it? How hard are you willing to sacrifice for it? That's the question. And I believe anyone can do anything, including go to space. But like, how hard are you willing to work for it? Like, that's the question. And I think now more than ever, there's an opportunity to outwork everyone. Like, I mean, it was hard for people like you and I to be successful because everybody worked really hard. It's not as many people working as hard. And I don't mean to put people down, but like, this is a time more than ever to succeed, you know, if you're willing to work. But anyway, so yeah, so this is 20 years ago. I was like, all right, I want to be on TV. And I just went out and asked everybody I knew, every single person. And my dad had taught me very early. He said, you're going to get 99 no's before you get a yes. And my dad was in sales. And
sure. That was good advice.
Yeah. So he goes, when you get that 99th no, you get that 97th or that 96th or that 85th or that 55th, like, don't get depressed. That means you're one more closer. Like, you're almost there. And so he really taught me early. I mean, this was at 16. And he told me, he said, you're never going to be the best looking. You're never going to be the best dressed. You're never going to be the richest. You're never going to be the smartest. You're never going to be the, you know, strongest. He's like, all you have is effort. Like, that's all God gave you. And he goes, you will outwork everybody. He's like, that's what you can control. Everything else, you're going to be like fifth or sixth place. And that's a hard thing to hear when you're 16. But it's an amazing thing to confidently know when you're 21 and 22 and 23. And so I was years ahead of my colleagues because I was already beaten down. I didn't care. Like, I'd get told no. And I was like, all right, 96, 94 to go.
You know, how did you get hoarders? What led to that?
Nobody wanted to do it. They had looked and looked and looked. And I had YouTube came out that year. It was the year YouTube came out. And they were paying $30 if you put a video up the first year. So there was not enough content. So people listening, there was not enough content yet on YouTube. And you talk about the stars aligning. A kid that worked for me on the side, he was in film school and he was trying to put something on YouTube to get $30. So he goes, what we do here is kind of cool. Can I just film a hoard? And I was like, yeah. And so he did. And I mean, we were kids and we put it on YouTube. And within 2 days, I got a call from a production company in Seattle. They're like, we're making a TV show called Hoarders. We need one more episode to wrap up the six. And I think they were paying, it was $300 an episode. And I was like, that I'm a millionaire. I was
like, that's like 10 YouTube videos.
It was $1 million. Right. And I remember I went and I didn't have enough money to get home and I didn't know that they were going to get reimbursed. I thought they would just pay my way. And so I didn't have enough money to eat dinner on the first episode of Hoarders because you were getting reimbursed. I was broke, man. But like, it was amazing. And within, you know, 8 weeks later, I'm on the Tonight Show with Leno. I mean, it was crazy. And no one knew the show would take off. Turns out I had the right personality for it. And I had been quietly hustling for 5 years. And we didn't know that it was for that moment, you know. And I'll take that further. I mean, like, my business now, Clutter Cleaner, I mean, we help families all over the world right now with downsizing and estate cleanouts. And it's all the things that I learned that first 10 years, right? And I had no kids, no family, no money. I was sleeping in hoarded houses. I was doing anything I could to get by. But like, it sounds very romantic, but like in a movie way, but like it was for now. It wasn't for back then. It was just, that hustle was just, that was just part of the journey. And so like, I love that, like how hard it was. It was harder back then. But like I tell for the young kids, I'm like, dude, you got, it's a 10-year grind before like you even see any ounce. But like for me, it was just thousands and thousands of families to help them. And I announced it at Smash, actually. I am going to retire. I just have to help a million families first.
That's right.
And that's it. Just a million.
And hey, you're well on your way.
We're under 1,000 still. We're like 800 something. But it'll take me 10 years and I'm okay with that. But if I truly help a million families, I think it's time to retire. It's okay.
Like I think you've achieved something.
So but think of how many families are going to have to be involved in that for us to do that, right? Like I'll have to have 100 Clutter Cleaner as a franchise organization. We'll have to have 150 franchises to do that. But is it possible? Sure. Anything's possible. If you actually, how hard are you willing to work for it? And I'm seasoned for that. I'm ready. You know, we took 300 people. Are saying, what's the worst thing you ever found? We took 300 cats out of a lady's house one time. Live.
They were alive. I was just going to ask that, but yeah.
Oh yeah, it'd be easy if they weren't. The first 50, they're just fat and hungry and they'll walk up to you. But those last five, they're wild animals, dude. Yeah. They're hunting you, you know? Yeah. Those last five were impossible to get. And that was a hard house.
Yeah.
Right. So if I can do that, the last cat, remember the lady, she was like, I've named them all. And I was like, great, give me the names. And she starts rattling off names. And by the time she got to 30 names, she's kind of like, Fang 2, Jimmy 3, you know, so funny. She's like, all right, I didn't name them all. Fine. You win. And it was we broke, right? And we all burst out laughing. And then there was no longer this ridiculous, I'm in charge. And then we were finally just all laughing. And then it became an easy job. And I will say to this day, there's no Fang was the last cat that
right.
I wanted. And she did name it. It was just one. We couldn't get him. The cat was hiding in drywall. We had to take the drywall down to get him.
Wow.
And his name was Fang and he was aptly named. And Fang went through, I had two pair of welding gloves on and Fang could bite through two pair of welding gloves.
Wow.
And this was a Sunday afternoon, dude. I think I was doing this for $15 an hour.
Yeah.
But that's what you got to go through to, you know, and now here we are now. I get to travel the world with my kids and my best friends and we help families all over the world. What an amazing.
I love that. Thing, that's great.
Right? What an amazing. And got to speak on stages and meet guys. I really do have an amazing job, but it's because we're helping people. It's not because that's it. The pureness of it is if we weren't helping people, this wouldn't be special. I'm not cool. What I'm doing is cool.
Yeah. Well said. Right? Well said.
You know, you have to always remember that in business.
Now, one thing I'm curious about, we talk about the different generations. There was the silent generation, the greatest generation. Right now, the boomers are, the ones that are really accessing senior living. Gen X, millennials, Gen Z are coming behind. How do they differ in their relationship with stuff? We see it all the time. Parents want to pass things down, as we talked about early in the conversation, and kids don't want it. And that's become a meme now in a lot of cases.
I will not have a job in 30 years, to answer your question. My career, the industry that I've created will disappear in 30 to 40 years. This is going to blow your mind. And by the way, I was an economist before I did this. I was an economist for the Federal Reserve. So I love data. Data to me is the most important thing in the world. I don't need to make decisions. I don't think you should make difficult decisions. I think the math should make the decisions for you. So my grandparents, the greatest generation, millennials right now behave a lot like the greatest generation. They're looking at experiences. They're looking at reused goods. They are not looking at mass stuff. I'm Gen X. We're the IKEA generation. Goodwill won't even take IKEA stuff. Let me say that again. Goodwill will not take IKEA stuff. If that doesn't answer your question.
Completely disposable.
So we've hit that and now we're coming back. All right. So that bell curve is changing. You are seeing, you've never seen a bigger demand for used goods. I've talked to Walmart about reselling used goods. I've talked to Amazon about selling used goods. I do believe the way the economy, and I'm not trying to get political, but it's a tough town. It's a tough place right now, politically. It doesn't matter which side you're on. It's split and it's tough and it's expensive and we're all about to be broke. And so I think you're going to see a mass switch to used goods, quality goods, reusing them, fixing them. I'd find a pair of boots and I would find four or five pair of resold shoes. We're going to see that again.
Yep. Great point.
And I think it's not a bad thing for our country. It's not a bad thing for people to learn how to redo things. You're seeing people do gardens again. You're seeing people grow their own food because it's just become economically not feasible. And guess who experienced that too? Because of political and war, so did our grandparents, greatest generation. So I think you're going to see, to get really deep, I think it's a reset our world needs. Technology has
has taken too much over. And, you know, I think it's going to be interesting when the internet breaks, because it will at some point. The internet will break or disappear. That's what World War III looks like. From what I understand, that's what World War III looks like, is we just don't have internet. So we won't have cell phones. We won't have internet. I mean, I think of how my kids will prevail in that. It's going to be a tough couple weeks.
Yeah.
It's going to be a tough couple, you know, a couple months. And I'm not saying the world disappears, but I'm saying it will be a reset that I think will be interesting and will look a lot like our grandparents did.
Yeah, the whole cybercrime and whatnot is interesting to think about how that can take things down. But
yeah,
interesting.
I mean,
so I want to take a few minutes to play something we're calling Keep It or Kick It.
Oh, I like it.
I'll name a few things that people like to hang on to, and you tell me if it's something we should keep or kick.
Okay,
ready? Old trophies.
Kick it. Don't need them.
Completely?
Yeah. It's not who you are. It's something you did.
Yep. Good. Wedding China.
Go earn a new one. Wedding China. Keep one, kick the rest.
Oh, I like that. Why?
Celebrate what you had. Doesn't matter if you're with the person or not. Celebrate what you had.
That's really smart.
Yeah. Or use it. I mean, you know, that's really what I say. I just use it all. Like, put it in the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. The lady that's going to be upset that you're putting the china in the dishwasher died 15 years ago. It's cool. Don't worry about it.
Yep.
Use it.
Great point.
I do see family. Yeah, this is a tough one because this is one people really struggle with. I do see families crack it up and make vases and stuff out of it where they can reuse. So repurposing china is a really cool way to go.
Like that. Childhood artwork.
Childhood artwork. Take a picture of it and kick it.
Nice. Boxes of VHS tapes.
Don't even look. Just toss it. Kick it.
Interesting.
You haven't looked in 30 years.
Yep.
You haven't looked in 30 years, so why look now?
A cookbook collection.
You'd be surprised. I would go through them. I'm big on artifacting. Take pictures of the ones that, and then get rid of it.
Interesting. Yeah. And taking pictures of old pictures and other things, even the, not the chair, because you can interact with that, but other kinds of mementos.
So
that's one of the things I've really learned is that
kids art you talk about, we call it mediocre art. That's what it is. It's mediocre art.
Yep.
And if your kids were artists, that they'd already be special. They're not. So they're an artist in something else in the world.
Sure.
So it's really mom that's holding on to that. It's not, the kid doesn't give a shit. He doesn't care.
Yep.
Like, get rid of it. But we use an app called Artifacts, ArtiFcts.
Yep. I've connected with those folks. They're great.
They're amazing. Heather's amazing. We use it in all of our clutter. We use it with all of our families, and you can take a picture of the item. But like I'll be artifacting a couple recipes this week. Like, I love artifacting. So yeah, recipes, take the pictures and then make them. Don't just take it because it's there. Make a recipe. Get the smells that your grandma used to do. Like, do it with this next generation and pass it on.
That's great. That's great.
Keep it and then toss it.
Every birthday card ever.
Look for money, get it rid of it.
That's true. You don't want to just toss them out without going through them.
No, this is a horrible story, but I got to tell it. I had one lady that, we were cleaning her basement out and her husband let me in upstairs. He's like, she's downstairs. And we had a box full of sympathy cards. And she's like, oh, that's from my husband's funeral. And I go, did I just meet your husband? She's like, oh, that's my second husband. She goes, we've been married for 20 some years. She goes, these are sympathy cards from my first husband. And I go, when did he die? She's like, in the 70s. I was like, don't you think we can get rid of these? She's like, I don't know. I feel like I should go through. I was like, first of all, your husband's a saint.
Right.
If anyone's alive, I go, here's the deal. I go, let's go through 10. If any of those people are alive, we can keep them. And I said, pick 10 random ones. And she just picks them out. And 8 out of 10 were already dead. And she's like, all right, you made your point. Let's just toss them. Now, one thing I would say is I take leaps. I'm really big on leaps. If you are going to sort them, and then if you say, I'm going to keep them, I just got to go through them first. Going through first never happens. So just take the leap, man. Just toss them. You haven't looked at them. It's just like the negatives on your photographs. You've never looked at the photographs, but you're afraid to throw them away. You've never used a negative in your entire life. How is your life going to be different if you toss it? It's not.
Great point.
You're just going to have more space. So just leap. Take the leap, man.
Great point. Yeah. Unused kitchen gadgets.
Get rid of them. Donate them. You don't need them.
I guess the key there is unused, right? Clothes that might fit someday.
They don't fit today. Get rid of them. I go one up and one down. So I'm a 36. I keep 34s. I never went to 38. I don't need to keep my 28s.
Yeah. Yeah. Good point.
I was 15.
Yeah.
When I did. I didn't get rid of them.
Kids or grandkids, old toys?
Toss. Toys are honestly, so, you know, we had a lot of kids. Toys, I think, are one of the worst things because you keep them because you don't want to get rid of your kids' childhood. They don't get, let the kids donate it. So I let the kids make the decision. You as the adult have to go through. The kids ready to donate it? Donate it.
That's smart.
And there's a lot of kids that need toys. So donate them to people that need them. That's Donation's great. A huge tool. Donation's not just the right thing to do. It's an easier way to trick yourself to get rid of something in a positive. I mean, donation is an amazing thing. If you can find a place you actually care about and you align with their mission, donate. Like, I promise you. And I work for Goodwill, and I'm telling you, we don't care if you donate at Goodwill or not. Donate wherever you're aligned. If you align with their mission, donate there, and it'll help you clean your house. I mean, I tell this all the time. I mean, I have 20-some teams for Clutter Cleaner that clean houses. We'll have 100 locations in the next 2 years. I will raise my family and pay for all my kids to go to college because people like you can't let go of their stuff. All you have to do is donate it, and I would be out of business. That's all I got to do. Give it away for free. And you get your life back, you get your house back, and I'd be okay with it. It'd be fine.
That's great. And like you said earlier, with the next generations coming up, and it really feeds that kind of reuse market and that philosophy of sustainability, I guess, at the core.
And this is what blew me away. I mean, I used to really be negative on Goodwill, and they heard me say something on stage and they invited me. They said, come any location in the country. And I was like, I happened to be in Richmond, Virginia that day. They're like, great, come today. I was like, okay. I gave them like 20 minutes. I showed up and they said, pick an item. And I was like, what do you mean? We're going to follow it all the way through. So I grabbed a pair of jeans and I followed it all the way through the Goodwill Center. And I found out if you donate it, who touches it, who has a job. And it's, you don't realize how many people have jobs, how many people of, disabled people and people without means that get to have jobs there. But what blew me away is how much recycling they do. I mean, if the jeans aren't sellable, then they go and they get recycled and they get turned into insulation.
Wow. That's one of the things I was thinking as we were talking is seeing the video of like floating trash and third world countries that are having piled up.
Nothing gets wasted at Goodwill. I think it's like less than 8% that gets tossed into the landfill.
That's really encouraging.
Yeah, and I will tell you, like, I cannot stress, like, people will reuse more and more, and that's only going to become as the economy changes over the next the next 8 years. I think you're really going to see people reuse more and more and more and more. And I mean, even my kids love thrifting now. It's crazy. Like, they get really good clothes there. And I mean, I got a pair of jeans there. They're for like $12. And I was like, oh my God, these are $150 jeans. Yeah. And I'm like, this is great. But like, I cannot, the recycling and the repurposing is really, really special. And it's gonna, the more you do that, especially when you know the story from your grandparents, like, now it's a special, more special item.
Sure. That's great. So you've seen how tough these transitions can be. I mean, you've been living it for decades now. How can senior living communities better support new residents through right sizing and life transitions? Related to that, I would love to get your thoughts on the term downsizing versus right sizing. Is there really any difference, or is it trying to rebrand the same thing?
They're rebranding the same thing. It's the same thing. I, for some people, right sizing is the right word. For me, it's brutally honest. Look, you're downsized. You're going from a 5,000 square foot home to a 500 square foot apartment.
Might make you feel better by calling it right sizing, but it's.
Yeah. But the reality is what it is.
So, how can community support that?
Yeah, I think giving them a space to share the stories, like, and then more importantly, giving a space to create new memories. Like, it's not just a home. Like, people, you and I know, because we're close to the communities, we know how great they are. Like, they can be incredible. The food, I mean, oh my God, to have the food, the quality of food that you have at your fingertips with the safety of the, of the medical stuff there. And then to have the community, like, my mom moved into a community 3 years ago and I don't get to see her that much because she's so busy, like, she's doing so well there. So I think, it's important for people to understand, like, get into the community. I think communities need to use their space for younger, like, not just immediate prospects, like, let it be an actual community. Let people from the generationally below go in there and participate and use the stages and use the auditoriums. Like, get people in there and hear the stories. I think the most important stories, I mean, you've heard me for the last hour tell these incredible stories about my clients. Those stories need to be told, and I think the senior living communities need to be the hub for that. And you need to be recruiting your clients that are 50 right now, but they need to be showing up for a senior show and tell or a senior story hour so they get comfortable with your community. It's more about truly making it a community. That is what senior living, and getting those next 40s and 50 year olds. Because if you do that, I mean, you know, like a lot of colleges have gotten really good at that. Like they're letting kids, I mean, like my kids get my, I live in Georgia. My kids in high school, they go and play at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Every high school gets to play there. And then they get to go to University of Georgia for a field trip in elementary school. And then they get to go play in middle school on that field. So you think, where do you think these kids want to apply to go to college when they go to college? They want to go to Georgia because their parents have been watching it. All their friends wear it. They see every elementary school here, their mascot is a bulldog. Like they have done an incredible job, almost to a cult level, of the younger generation is showing up at their college. And it's something the community can use. And so when it is time to go there.
It's a great analogy.
And that college is thriving. Senior living communities need to do the same thing. Yep. You already have the space. You're not using it.
That's great.
What expense do you have, honestly?
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And what a great way to showcase the life that's within the community.
Just go do what you already do. Just invite more of the world in to see it. I'm not asking you to be anything different. I want you to be as great as you are. Just get more people in there to see it.
Well said, well said. So last question. What have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
It'll work out. It just does.
That's great.
All the time it may not be easy.
It's simple but profound.
Yeah, it works out. And, you know, I read this somewhere online. Everything you worry about never happens.
Like, that's great.
Your life just works out. Yep. If you're giving it your best and you're showing up, you're 100% devoted and you're showing up, it works out. It may not be what you thought it was going to be, but that's okay.
Yep.
It works out. Like, good Lord, y'all, if y'all knew my whole story, like, it is crazy that you listened to me for an hour. I mean, I was walked out of a casino at 24 because I was being fired from my job. And I still, to this day, cannot go to Caesar's Palace. I am barred from Caesar's Palace. And that is a true story. And I'll tell you that story over a beer someday. But, like, it worked out.
That's great.
I'm the luckiest guy in the world. It just took 10 years longer than most of my friends. And that's okay.
Yeah. You know? But boy, how did it work out for you? It's amazing what you've accomplished, what you've achieved. Matt, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. This has been a lot of fun, you know, interesting, inspiring. So thank you.
Thank you. If anyone listening tonight, when you're with your family over the holidays of the next couple months, just have the oldest person in the room, just have them point out one item and say, tell me a story about that item. I promise you, you'll have a different life if you do that. One item, one story, it'll change your life forever.
That's great. That's great. Well, thank you. And thank you to everybody listening. I'm Derek Dunham. And thanks also to Dave Schaffner, our producer, Matt Campbell, our engineer. And again, Matt Paxton, that's, I think, a great way to end it. When you're here over the holidays, ask the oldest person in the room to tell a story about one item.
Your life will be different from here on forward.
Hey, thanks very much.
Thanks, man. Appreciate you.
Bye-bye.